Hello and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. Today, of course, is March 8th, the year of our Lord 2023. And we're back again today to continue discussing the American economy and try and make some sense of the financial news as we move forward. Again, I want to thank our sponsor of this program, Swiss America, an excellent purveyor of precious metals, gold, silver. And I encourage all of you, if you have an interest in investing in precious metals, to give them a call at 1-800-519-6271 and ask them for their free investor guide. And they'll mail it out to you. You can take a look and see what they have to say. And then if you have further questions, give them a call, and I'm sure they'll be able to help you out. I wanted to talk about a few things. We had a little bit of a carryover from yesterday. We sort of went down the rabbit hole of cryptocurrencies, and I wanted to maybe just bring you up to date on that and talk about the beginnings and the nature of that idea. And let me just spend a little bit of time on cryptocurrencies right now, and then we'll talk about some of the items in the news here as well. If you think about how currency works, and I used my example yesterday of my now well shop-worn dollar, this is the legal tender used in the United States of America. We have $1 bills, $5 bills, $10 bills, $20 bills, and $100 bills. And that's as big as they let people use, because bills larger than that, you start to be able to move money around rather conveniently. In the olden days, we would have a $500 bill, and we have a $1,000 bill. And of course, there were other bigger bills than that for interbank transactions. But if you notice, if you take a look at your money, the $5 bill is the same size as the $1, the $10, the $20 are all the same size. Even a $100 bill is the same size as the $1 bill. So, you know, when you think about this as a commodity, what is this? A piece of paper with some special ink and some special engraving. And I'm sure inside the paper is some secret stuff that makes this counterfeit proof. But the point is, all the bills are the same size. So when you look at value, what's the difference between $100 and a $1 if the piece of paper is the same size? You know, so you have to have this determination mark, and you have to believe that this piece of paper is a $1 bill and this one's a $100 bill. Same size, same paper, same green ink, the whole nine yards.
Although the new $100 bills actually are fairly fancy. There's a little
thing crawling up there. Anyway, so how this comes about is that there's a government, whether it's a king or ancient Greeks or whoever, will stamp out a certain amount of money, of dollars. Let's just use dollars as the currency. So they'll print up a certain number of dollars, and those are in circulation in the economy, and that's what the economy has to work with respect to a store of value. You work hard, and you know, a day's work, and you get paid. That's the store of value, is this, these paper dollars or coins, and that's traditionally how we've monetized our existence, by being productive, whether you work with your hands or work with your back or work with your brain or whatever, feet, whatever, you get paid money. And of course, if you think about it, the amount of money in circulation is very, very important, because as we see now with an absolute flood of currency into the economy, dollars are very easy. They're not scarce. And when things are not scarce, they're not worth much. So it's a great way to create inflation by pumping dollars into the economy and heating it up. And then if you want to cool off the economy, you pull dollars out of the economy. We talked about that yesterday, how the Federal Reserve, through its open market efforts, will buy bonds, and which means putting new Federal Reserve notes into the economy, and it stimulates the economy. There's more dollars zipping around. And then when they want to slow things down, they sell bonds out of their portfolio and take dollars out of the economy. And then there's fewer dollars, interest rates go up. It's a function of supply and demand. So that's effectively what you want to do in a reasonable, responsible world, is to create an economy or fund an economy with dollars that hold value, and they don't inflate, they don't deflate. They're just the unit of measurement, you know, the unit of the store of value, that's a unit measurement of exchange. So when we talk about cryptocurrencies, if we have the problem with paper dollars, where there's too many of them, and they're way out in circulation, and we know that because we have a $32 trillion deficit, which means that there's $32 trillion in debt that was monetized and spent. There's a lot of money in this thing, and that's why we're seeing this increase in inflation. So if we wanted to think about an alternative method of money, and that's what cryptocurrencies are, it's a different way to create money, but there's still the same problem. If you have a printing press, you can create lots and lots of money, and there's no value attached to the new dollar coming out, the crypto coin coming out, okay, this new currency. And that's what counterfeiting is all about, and that's why when you look at what we colloquially refer to as banana republics, or maybe the Weimar Republic in Germany, they just printed because they needed to spend money on all these social programs and all this expansion and infrastructure and all this stuff. And of course, if you can print currency and people accept it as currency and use it, then you can flood the market with it, where the value of an individual unit deteriorates as you have this vast ocean of dollars. That's why you saw images back in the 1930s or late 20s of people in Germany pushing a wheelbarrow full of Deutschmarks to the bakery to buy a loaf of bread. And lots and lots of these. You also saw that in Zimbabwe, unfortunately, in the not too recent past, about inflation raging in that country, that they just keep adding zeros to the new bills they're printing and thinking somehow that's going to stabilize it, when all in fact all it does is create more money. So the issue with cryptocurrencies is you're trying to create a currency that's detached from a Federal Reserve or a central bank or a government. And the idea was a very democratic, small d democratic idea, that if money is a representation of your human value, or excuse me, your human output, economic value of your human output, then you should be able to create a unit of exchange based upon your efforts, your value added to society, and people can create money, and then that money goes into circulation and everybody will recognize the money and accept it. So the problem with that, of course, is if it's linked to a day's work in the field, let's say you're picking weeds by hand, or you're shoveling, or you're laying bricks, or maybe, doing something for 8 hours, you can quantify that, which would be based somewhat on the hourly wage. And you'd create a value, and then you'd have a unit of exchange, which would be some sort of a coin. And if you could create your own coin, if everybody created their own coins, nobody would accept each other's coins. It has to be a standardized measurement throughout society. So the idea was with crypto, if we can create a finite number of crypto coins, and people accept those at value, and they all accept it at the same value. Maybe a dollar today, it's kind of hard to use this example because I don't know what you can buy for a dollar. I guess you can go into the dollar store and there's something you can buy for a dollar. It's not a gallon of milk. It's not a loaf of bread. Well, let's say it's a loaf of bread. Okay, we'll just pretend. And if I know that I have $1 and I can get a loaf of bread and I can live on a loaf of bread, if I eat that for a day, I'll make it till tomorrow, then that becomes a standardized unit of exchange. So the question is, in a crypto world, how do you create the money and who gets to create it? Because, I don't know how to create digital money. I have no clue how digital money is created. And, I'm sure people that work for a living, most of us don't. I mean, who has that knowledge? Well, I did a little research in this. And, of course, cryptocurrency is created through a process called mining. And, you're not out there digging in the backyard with a shovel looking for cryptocurrency. What effectively it means is that there are computers that analyze and calculate, and effectively they solve complex math problems. And when you solve the math problem, then you get a crypto coin. And, if you take one example, Bitcoin was the first coin to come out. And it's one of the brands out there. It's as good as any coin, I guess. But the idea was it came out and it was pretty cheap, and now they're trading in the, you know, $50,000-$60,000 range for one coin. And these are invisible coins. Like I showed you one yesterday. Here, here's a Bitcoin, right? Here it is, right here. You know, you can see it. So what happens is you get this system where these things are being mined, and it takes a lot of electric power or energy to run these computers to mine Bitcoins. And I guess if you run these things long enough, and hard enough, you can actually mine a coin, which is kind of counterintuitive to the idea that it's based on the value of your human efforts. If you set up a computer and you run it all day long, and the computer does all the work and creates a coin, then I guess you're the beneficiary, even though you had to spend capital, which is of course the cost of the computer and the electricity. You have to plug it in, turn it on, and pay the electric bill, which is so basically your operating cost to generate a Bitcoin. And of course, only a few people know how to do this. So it's not really a small D Democrat type thing. This is much more of a group of elite specialists that know how to create Bitcoin or cyber coins, crypto coins. And then these things somehow get into a wallet, and then you can spend them, other people will accept them, and then into circulation they go. And it's a noble idea, but the question always becomes whether it's in printing American dollars by the Federal Reserve, or if it's the Continental Congress printing up, you know, continental dollars where something wasn't worth a continental because there were too many in circulation. How do you regulate the mining of Bitcoin or I should say a crypto coin? And how do you regulate that? I mean, how do you know that the people who mine these things aren't going to do the same thing the Federal Reserve does? They print up a zillion of these. The value of each individual dollar declines, and eventually there are too many, and then they flood the system, and that's an inflationary pressure. So that, I think, remains to be seen how that all plays out in that particular sector. And as you know, as individual Americans, we think about places to invest and put your money, and I think you have to be very careful about that, because the story I talked about yesterday, that Silvergate Bank, and they shut their Silvergate Exchange network. And effectively what that network did is it took Federal Reserve notes, the digital version of these, okay? These exist as paper, but they also exist as a digital version. And you have to convert your American dollars into cryptocurrency. And how do you do that? Well, first of all, you have to have American dollars because the whole thing is monetized by dollars. I mean, you think about it, what people are trying to do is escape the dollar and get into crypto and then begin to transact in cryptocurrencies. But they have to have the dollar to get in. Unless you're going to set up a computer in your basement and run all this, you know, and figure out how to mine Bitcoins. And I'm sure there's services, and you probably Google it and figure out how to go about doing that. The easier way, of course, is to take your American dollar and convert it to crypto. But you can do the same thing with taking your American dollar and turning it into a euro. Or, you know, pick a currency, and effectively, what you're trying to do is change the base of your money to a crypto platform. And then you have to assume that the currency that you're buying is not going to explode in volume so that what you paid a dollar for is now worth 3 cents, because there's unlimited amounts of this stuff pouring in. Nobody wants them because, you know, they're plentiful. So that becomes a big part of the risk of crypto when you're investing in that space. And it's something that's probably going to take a little bit of time to even out. As to whether a cryptocurrency becomes, a global standard, it's really hard to say, because you have this power struggle between big governments who control the money, and they control the money supply, like the United States. They would prefer you not be buying and selling in crypto, because they like to keep an eye on what you're doing. This is the land of the free, you know, home of the brave. But the reality is, like, if you look at your IRS filings, and of course it's tax season, everybody's figuring out their income taxes. They're asking questions. You know, did you do any transactions in crypto? You know, well, they want to know. So the idea is that, you know, and it's always a conflict between individuals with the right of privacy who just want to be left alone and do their business and basically go humbly among the earth, okay? And then naughty people who end up doing things nefariously, and they use these types of finance vehicles to finance terrorism or drug dealing or other terrible things. So, it, you know, it's always the fact that, you know, the bad sort of squeezes out the good. There's probably nothing wrong with having a currency that is effectively undetectable and just basically is a private thing. Matter of fact, we actually have that in the United States, because if you do your transactions in cash, you know, this isn't showing up on any digital screen anymore. And that's the problem from a law enforcement perspective, and a regulatory perspective, national security perspective. They don't want bad people doing things anonymously, and then good people who just prefer not to be public are the victims. You know, it's hard for you to be, you know, private and anonymous when everybody's looking for bad guys, when you yourself are not a bad guy. So these are social issues that we will have to work our way through as time goes on, as we always do. But the idea of cryptocurrency is here to stay. It's probably the future, and we just need to figure out how in the world you go from, you know, literally 10,000, maybe 6,000, 8,000 years of traditions of using coins as money. And we still have coins, of course. And then, you know, relatively recently, hey, well, instead of doing the coin thing, I would just print it on paper, and then, you know, we go to a digital thing. Another interesting thing about crypto that is problematic: if you're creating a medium of exchange, you're effectively trying to do a very stable medium, a unit, like the dollar. When inflation happens, we get nervous about it. And of course, I'm holding up a dollar. When I was a kid, this was a lot of money. I mean, people could go to the grocery store and buy food for the day for a dollar and have change left over. You're not doing that today. You're not going to the grocery store. But at the end of the day, you knew that a dollar was a dollar was a dollar. And the only thing deteriorating that value, of course, was inflation. But with this cyber currency phenomenon, the speculators are in that market in droves. The idea is, if I buy a cryptocurrency today, it's going to go up in value next week, and I will have made a profit on speculation. And that's a different model. When you think about a unit of exchange, a basic thing like a dollar, this is really a tool to make your economy hum along. So if I take this dollar and I put it in my wallet on Monday and I pull it out on Friday, it's still a dollar, okay? The idea with crypto is, if you buy it on Monday and you sell it on Friday, it's worth $1.05. But when I look at my wallet on Friday, I pull out my paper dollar, there's no nickel that falls out the bottom. Okay, it's going to be a dollar, and it's not going to produce a nickel. Nickels don't come from dollars, okay? It's still a dollar. So when you add a speculative component to digital currency, then is it a medium of exchange, or is it a vehicle of speculation? There's nothing wrong with speculation, but when we're talking about the stability, you wouldn't want to open your wallet on Friday. I'm going to be careful here, I hate myself. But, you know, and you open your wallet, and this is what you see. You say, hey, what happened to the other, you know, that part of my dollar? Wow, inflation, you know, open it up next week. Here's what you're going to get next week, buddy. We don't want to see that. We just want to see the stability. So when you add a speculative component, that becomes questionable as to whether you're gambling or whether you're just using a dollar to, or a unit of measurement of, you know, a unit of measure to capture the value of your life's worth. So things to think about. I think, you know, if you're going to get into crypto, you need to call that 800 number and ask for their free investor guide and do a lot of research on it, because I think that's very important. You know, that's the beautiful thing about when you buy gold and silver. You buy an ounce of gold today, it will be an ounce of gold 3,000 years from now. I think I mentioned King Tut's helmet, you know, same size, same shape, as beautiful as it was the day they put it on them. That's precious metals. I think maybe 3,000 years from now, my dollar is going to look a little shopworn. But at the end of the day, you've got to be very careful, because if you're investing for the long haul, which is the base of your investment plan, you want to be putting money where it's stable. So I'd like to move on to a couple of news items I thought were fascinating today. Big news out of Washington, of course, is that President Biden proposes a 5.2% raise for federal employees because of inflation. Now, there's 2.1 million federal workers, and I'm sure they all do a very good job. You know, they work for the government. That's an important job. And I'm sure each and every one of those 2.1 million workers, and if there are federal workers watching, I apologize. But President Biden is asking for a 5.2% raise because of inflation. And of course, the headline is that the last time anyone asked for a raise that big was, you know, President Jimmy Carter back in 1980, and he asked for a 9.1% increase. That was 43 years ago. But that's an interesting phenomenon. You read this story, and then you start thinking, you know, the Democrats in Congress and their federal employees union were asking for an 8.7%. So Joe backed it down to 5.2. But, you know, at the end of the day, this becomes problematic because, number one, whatever the federal employees make, and I'm sure they're all, you know, I'm sure they think they're underpaid, but they're worth the pay. We, the taxpayers, pay the federal bill, and that's part of the federal budget. And of course, any raises given to federal workers, of course, just ends up on the taxpayers' bill, even though the taxpayers are only supporting about 68% of the federal spend, the rest of it's being borrowed. At the end of the day, you're either going to pay it directly or it's going to be added to our tab, and our tab is $32 trillion in debt. So it pushes the cost of government. And of course, other sectors of American society are watching this. They think, you know, inflation's humming along at 8% and federal workers are getting 5.2%. I should get a raise too. So suddenly across the American economy, workers are demanding more wages. And if you had the privilege of being alive in the 1970s and watching this from the perspective of a taxpayer, you know what happens. This cost push inflation really starts to drive the cost of living in the United States, because other unionized groups and other non-union groups, all workers would like to have a 5.2% increase. I would like that. You'd probably like to have one of those as well. So here we are, and we're looking at this from the federal government as something that's, you know, they're looking at it right now. That's going to cost some serious money. It's also interesting to note that the Social Security benefits went up by about 8.7% as well. And of course, if you're on Social Security, that's great news, because one of the things about being older and living on pensions and more of a fixed income is that the 8% inflation is hurting you today. And at least the cost of the Social Security benefit is going up, and that at least tries to keep you neutral. So, of course, if you can raise Social Security for retirees and for federal workers, then this is going to start trickling through the economy at a very quick pace. And also there's a continuing push for the minimum wage, you know, raise the minimum wage to $15 in certain markets. That's, you know, in certain markets, it's not a lot of money. In certain markets, it is. Always the push for more higher wages. And, of course, everybody wants higher wages. We all do. But what it does is it drives costs, because if you remember, when you have the classic business formula, revenues minus expenses is income, well, in order to keep your income constant and your wages go up and your revenues are coming down in a recession, you got to lay people off. So, you know, higher wages, but there's going to be some people that are going to get burned, basically. So I thought that was an interesting story, that old Joe's looking to pump, 5.2% raise. And it'll be interesting to see. There's obviously a lot of backlash on that, but I think at the end of the day, prices will adjust, and of course, workers deserve their pay. So this is, you know, there's nothing wrong with paying people for a good wage for a good day's worth of work. That's important. I also noticed that with respect to Medicare, which is something near and dear to the hearts of everybody over 65, since the beginning of Medicare, or at least the beginning of time, these programs have been going broke. You hear the Social Security is going broke, Medicare is going broke. And every 4 years during the presidential race, each guy is blaming the other one for, you know, you're going to make the system go broke. But they're proposing a tax increase for people who make over $400,000 a year, raise their Medicare tax from 3.8% to 5%. And there's some valuable logic in that, because once you turn 65, unless you work for a great big company or some other strange little exemptions, you're effectively on Medicare. And it would make a lot of sense that if people are relying on Medicare after age 65, and you have to, basically, once you hit 65, the private sector falls through the floor and it's done. You're gone. Now, you can stay on private plans if your spouse works at a big company or if you're working at a big company. But the reality is, for the vast majority of Americans, when you hit 65, you're in the Medicare program. And, you know, responsible government would fund that on an actuarial basis based upon life expectancy, cost of medicine, and do all the math and come up with a rate, and then that's the rate. Because that's how private sector insurance works, like auto insurance. You know, they figure out what's the cost of all the wrecks and everything, all the damage that's going to happen, and they calculate your premium, you pay your premium. Well, it's the same thing. We'd expect that type of excellence from the federal government as they run the Medicare program, and maybe they're getting there. But what you're going to have to do is calculate a rate for all workers who plan on using that system when you retire, or at least when you get to 65, and it's funded on a realistic base. So that's something we're watching. Another thing we're watching is that there's another move, you know, to balance the federal budget within 10 years. I'm not a big believer. I've been alive for too many 10-year periods hearing the same story out of Washington over and over again, and they're going to balance the budget. So they're going to cut $150 billion out of this budget just after sending $200 billion to the Ukrainians to perpetuate that situation. So at the end of the day, I'm not so sure that the federal government's going to be doing anything close to balancing the federal budget within the next 10 years. And even if they did, you still have the $32 trillion in debt that you've already racked up. And the debt service on that over time, and none of us will be alive. First of all, it'll never be paid off. But let's say it did. Let's say somebody got serious in Washington and said, all right, we're going to pay this all off. Well, you know, this is about 400 years from now, they're still going to be paying down $32 trillion in debt. So I guess the proletariat elector or investors here, we hear this news and whatever. It's not good news, because what it tells you is they got $200 billion for Ukraine. They're going to cut the federal budget by $150 billion and balance the budget in 10 years. And, you know, meanwhile, everybody's getting a raise. So anyway, the last item of news, we're getting close to the end here. But I did notice that the central banks, the story out today is the central banks continue to buy gold. And I was very interested in that. I thought, you know, why do central banks buy gold? Well, first of all, there's no interest. You don't have to pay interest, and you certainly aren't earning interest. It's a stable commodity, but there's no counterparty risk, third party or counterparty risk. When you buy gold, you own it. There's no note unless you bought it on leverage. There's no counterparty risk. You buy it. Say you buy it for, I think the spot price today is about $1,850. All right, so you buy an ounce of gold, put it in your drawer. It's still there. It's still an ounce. It doesn't grow. It doesn't shrink. It's there. That's one of the beautiful things about the noble metals, is that they don't deteriorate. They basically stay the same. So if you've got all these central banks that are buying up gold, you have to ask the question why. And of course, I'm going to talk about this more tomorrow, but it's effectively, if we end up with a situation where the $32 trillion in debt eats us up, you're going to have to remonetize, and gold's a good thing. So I would call Swiss America at 800-519-6271, ask them for their free packet, information packet, and think about whether that's an investment that you might want to do, as well as the central banks. You can be in the same space as they are. Anyway, thanks for listening. It's been great talking with you today. I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Have a great day. Bye.